As you know, the subject of this series is the philosophy of history. And we have set it within the framework of the cycle of the Phoenix, a cyclic pattern recognized by antiquity and more or less justified by modern thinking. We may not be prepared to explain why history breaks so conveniently into 600-year patterns, but we know this to be the case. And we realize also that within these patterns, certain processes continually repeat themselves, each time on a higher level, each time resulting in a powerful advance of the human estate. Nevertheless, as we measure the life of the individual, so we measure event patterns. And last week we considered, in general, the descent of this cycle over a considerable period of time, and gave special attention to that critical point which arose about B.C. 600. This was the beginning of what may be termed the Greek cultural period in the West. And from Pythagoras to the final collapse of Greek civilization, we have a cycle of approximately 600 years. For our purposes, we may begin with Pythagoras and the original Greek sophists, men of the caliber of Thales and Solon. And we bring the cycle to the close with the corruption of Greek civilization as a result of the dominance of the Roman Empire. Thus we have a pattern which leads through the glory of the age of Pericles to that inevitable age or advancement toward ultimate exhaustion of resource, which marks the collapse of a culture. Before, however, we go directly to our next cyclic point, which is the beginning of the Christian era, it is more or less a duty to unfold somewhat further the philosophical aspects of history, with special reference to the period leading up to the beginning of the Christian era. Factually and actually, history may be said to begin, at least for Western man, with the Christian viewpoint. We have no record that the Greek was an historian, nor was the Egyptian, nor the Chinese or Hindu of that period. History as we know it today did not exist, but there were certain instruments which we may generally regard as historical. Perhaps the most common of these ancient instruments was called the annals. And this very largely distinguished the Greek and Roman historical approach. An annal was a record of an era, a time, a dynasty, or perhaps merely of a family. An annal was therefore in China the record of a reign sequence, that is, the descent of a dynasty, such as the Ming or the Tang or the Han or the Wei. Historians, perhaps to increase their own favor or to find a framework upon which to build a romantic literary production, found it profitable to glorify dominant families and to cater to the hero-loving instinct of their people. The annal, therefore, was not history in the broad sense, but a small exclusive document. Into this document might be drawn occasionally some external circumstance or incident, but only in the terms that that incident was directly related to the principal concept or the principal purpose of the annal. The annal descended later into the medieval period of Christianity as the chronicle. The chronicle being a kind of fabulous account of things, lacking, however, the essential ingredient of history, namely connective tissue. History only began formally when man began to ask the effect of the past upon his own time, and the probable extension of both past and present into the future in which his children must live. This is what we call historical perspective. It did not exist. Each episode stood alone in ancient times. The moral implications, the ethical overtones, the spiritual imponderables were almost completely ignored. Now, to a degree, this is due to the peculiar development of the historical instinct in man himself. And now in the 20th century, we realize that actually we are reliving most of the ancient cycles of world advancement. Let us analyze our present situation. What we call history today is, for the average layman, merely an annal or a chronicle. We mean by that that if someone says history, we do not immediately have a picture of the interdependencies of times and nations and races and religions and doctrines. We merely think of history, for the most part at least, as the descent of European culture. If you ask the average person who has a so-called adequate education today to name you the first emperor of China, or the first emperor of Japan, or to date for you any of the important East Indian historical incidents, he cannot do it. He cannot do it because he has not approached history except in the terms of its direct relationship upon the way of life in which he now lives. Today, for us, history is primarily American history. And our emphasis outside of this is upon the circumstances which led up to American history, the relationships between the growth of the American historical pattern and that of surrounding states, the effect of other nations upon America, or perhaps to a measure, the effect of America upon other nations. But our point of view is essentially provincial, our own. And outside of this point of view, we have an instinctive inclination to depreciate the cultural existence of other peoples. Perhaps we frankly acknowledge that we do not know much about these subjects. Consider, for example, our knowledge of literature. We are well read, for the most part, in European and American literature, comparatively illiterate in the literature of any other people. Our only real source of ancient literature is the Greco-Roman complex. Today we can quote perhaps an occasional line from Homer, or perhaps meditate upon some wisdom of Cicero. But we cannot quote a line from the Zend Avesta. We cannot quote a line from the Tables of Sargon. Yet these other documents are, in terms of holistic history, just as important as anything that we have recorded. It is simply that we are still largely in the era of the annal. To us, the story of history is the story of how we arrived at our present situation. And while this remains, we cannot be said to have an essential or sound philosophy of history. Somewhere in this pattern, we realize that the prejudiced historian must always fail. And any group of historical projects which receive the supreme prejudice of national emphasis must, to a measure, prove unsound. Here we have the greatest temptation to distort, to protect and preserve the appearance of our own virtues, and to sacrifice, if necessary, other factors which are outside of the auric field of our historical intent. Thus we advance ourselves at the expense of others, and have therefore, for centuries, laid no foundation for our great need today, namely a one-world concept. We are unable to cope with it, simply because we've never been prepared for any such emergency. Yet in this world, there is a history in and of itself. History stands as a complete structure, independent of any nation, independent of any culture, for it is actually the record of the growth of man as a total being. Each generation can find itself in history, but no historical work which is limited by the perspective of generations can be truly history. This is the great deficiency which we find not only in our own perspective, but for the most part in the historical point of view of the ages which have preceded us. Thus we today have some popular histories that attempt an international viewpoint, such as the work of H.G. Wells. But unfortunately, we have not given the reading of these works a proper consideration due to the lack of preparedness in our own consciousness. We have come out of all kinds of historical reading with certain emphases, certain glamorized episodes, but we have not a truly historical perspective. Again, in the 19th century through literature, and in the 20th century through the medium of motion pictures and television, we have gradually come under another false historical point of view. We have developed what might be termed the heroic complex. We have taken individuals out of history, dramatized them, frequently misrepresented them totally, in order to compromise with the requirements of entertainment. We therefore produce pseudo-historical documents, which in themselves are a serious detriment to history, because they present situations not as they were, but in order to clarify the dramatic point of view of some individual situation or sequence. For instance, recent pictures dealing with great heroic families or outstanding dictators, generals, conquerors, are comparatively worthless simply because the facts are not correct and the historical perspective is totally distorted. A good example of this type of thing can be the average person's concept of the French Revolution. The only thing we think of is the Reign of Terror. The real perspective of this great struggle, from an historical, sociological point of view, we are unable to appreciate. Our knowledge of the French Revolution is built somewhat upon Dickens' great story of the Tale of Two Cities. Or perhaps our understanding of a certain level of French life is coined from the base metal of Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. These things do not tell us historical values, but from them we have created a patch quilt of opinions which we continue to hold, and which therefore close our minds to the direct and complete approach to our subject. All the way along, therefore, we have found it necessary to create new historical instruments And this is gradually being done. But the accomplishments are for the most part limited to learned journals with a circulation of 500 copies. By the time they are watered down to our common consumption and have been made highly palatable to the reader who studies while he runs, not much is left that has any essential value. The new instruments of history are mostly what we might term below the ground evidence. Below the ground means such monuments, such inscriptions, such excavated material, such reclaiming from ancient ruins and archaeological sites, as give us a new way of appraising the value of the classical historian. We have created discovery as a censorship upon tradition. We are no longer satisfied to accept the history given to us by Herodotus. It is no longer necessary for us to study Egypt through Greek and Roman reports. The development of a means of interpretation based upon the discovery of the Rosetta Stone has opened to us 5,000 years of Egyptian records. Little by little, we are escaping from the historical patterns which we once depended upon for orientation. And little by little, we are checking these patterns by more recent discoveries and by an increasing collection of literary, scientific, and anthropological artifacts. As a result, as one observer has noted, we have tumbled nearly all of ancient historians from their august thrones and condemned them by proof as inaccurate, prejudiced, or uninformed. Now, this does not mean that we should disregard them, neglect them, or ignore them. But what we must recognize is that they lack two proud facilities which we possess. First, they have no means of general communication and transportation. They were limited inevitably to areas. And much of their history came along caravan routes, by report and hearsay. They had no other source, no other means of verifying anything except contemporary events in their own areas. The second deficiency that rested very heavily upon the ancient historian was the lack of method or lack of pattern by means of which he was impelled to examine immediate evidence and weigh it. He was impelled only to accept or reject according to his own judgment. Today we do not follow this course. We are in a position to observe the censorship of the past upon the present. We know that certain antecedent causes must have preceded events. This the ancient historian did not know, therefore he did not search for them. We also must realize that every effect having a cause, even the most obvious circumstances in our way of life, may have subtle causes, which he was not in ancient times able to examine or had any incentive to do so. Thus our reports from the past give us a framework against which we must turn modern attention. And with this thought in mind, we will go to one of the most obvious examples of this situation, and that is religious history. Let us think of religious history as we even regard it today. Within the last 200 years, the entire approach to history on a religious level has departed from the speculative thoughts and procedures of the Scottish metaphysicians to the more sober and accurate findings of the field biblical archaeologist. Today, in the name of religious history, men are digging with their hands into the earth. They are not following the ancient fathers. They are not regarding the translation of a neglected patriarch as a tremendous contribution to history. They are out in the field, trying to find visible, factual evidence of the important, controversial points, or trying to fill in the desperate breaks in history relating to religious subjects. Thus, such a discovery as the Dead Sea Scrolls is in the spirit of modern religious history, in the spirit of religious archaeology. A few centuries ago, these scrolls would probably have been relegated to limbo. They would have been forgotten and neglected because they might have interfered with something. They might have changed our opinion. They might have stepped upon the toes of some prevailing orthodoxy. But today, scholars, both from theological seminaries and great colleges and universities of laymen, and belonging to many religious groups, are searching desperately for new and better meaning and stand perfectly prepared to admit that while religion may be a revelation, religious history is not. It is an accumulation and depends upon increasing discovery for its ultimate accuracy. This difference in perspective also points the way to many things that we all should know about. Factually, we are completely ignorant of many of the most interesting episodes in American history. We have accepted certain texts. We have never questioned them. We have thought of the American history as the story of independence. It is not. It is the story of a people striving for independence. And until we discover this, we have not discovered American history. American history is not a problem of trying to whitewash patriots or tear them down. One group is afraid of heroes, and the other group is afraid to lose any of them. The facts remain that history is the story of average persons fighting their way toward goals, to a degree average, but above those previously attained. So with these patterns to consider, let us now approach the historical perspective with which we are concerned this evening. The circumstances, historically, philosophically considered, involving this critical period in the great Phoenix cycle, which we call the beginning of the Christian era. The beginning of an era is always the end of an era. These two must inevitably come together. Something must cease, decline, or fall away from dominance if another factor is to ascend and attain dominance. Just as in the motion of the generations of men, the rulership of the world rests with a generation for perhaps 20 years. Then that generation gradually fades away, and rulership passes to another generation. The motion is so imperceptible that we are hardly aware of it. But continuance, as we know it, is a continual ending and beginning, a continual falling away and a building up, a continual process of the creation of a vacuum and then the filling of that vacuum by natural laws flowing in and taking the place of that which has departed. That which departed in the cycle with which we are most concerned was the golden age of Greek culture. an age that was distinguished for attainments in science, philosophy, art, music, literature, and letters. An age of extraordinary philosophical illumination. An age which produced perhaps more outstanding creative thinkers than any other recorded era in history. Yet, as we pointed out before, this was not a situation that was purely local. For this Phoenix cycle seems to have something to do with a great clock in the universe. For that which was occurring in the Grecian culture was paralleled by extraordinary and important changes in other parts of the world. The rise of Taoism and Confucianism in China. The great Buddhistic reforms in India. The restoration of the Avestic tradition in Persia. These events were paralleling those which were occurring in the Mediterranean area. Now, as we go forward 600 years, we see in the Grecian states philosophy deteriorating away under the pressure of great problems of utility. The rise of the Roman Empire disturbed many aspects of man's culture. In one way, for example, it disturbed leisure. In another, it presented man with one of the first great expositions of the problem of the victory of brute force over morality and culture. It forced man to assume that good could not vanquish evil unless good was also stronger than evil. Stronger in the sense that good was supported by better human beings and more of them than evil. The philosopher could be taken out into the arena and fed to the lions by a despot. The greatest poet could starve to death. The great scholar could live and die neglected. And a comparatively worthless patrician could enjoy all the advantages of living. It was a period of disillusionment in which man was losing faith in the great theoretical concepts which he had concerning the operations of natural law. Theories, given opportunity of application, were not able to demonstrate their immediate utilities. Socrates was a good and wise man, and he was poisoned by the Athenians as a reward. Aristotle was a great and learned man. He was banished. One by one, those who were devoted to truth found themselves confronted with an adamantine wall of error. They discovered that power was moving gradually into the hands of aristocratic minorities or into militaristic sects. It is the same concept that is described of the philosopher when the king Minos showed him his treasure houses. The philosopher said to the king, "You have more gold than anyone in the world, but you will lose it to the first man who has better iron." This was what the classical world was discovering. It was learning by the terrible example of the Roman Empire that what we term materialism was a fact to be reckoned with. That it was not merely the minority conception of a few selfish persons, but that it had a tremendous hypnotic power over all people, and that against it only the strongest and the firmest could stand. And they stood alone. This decision, this conclusion, might never have come upon Mediterranean culture had it not been that a highly cultured people, the Greeks, were conquered by a comparatively uncultured group, the Romans. The Greeks also had the spectacle of observing that the iron of Rome not only toppled over the altars to the philosophic gods of Greece, but also toppled over the altars of 100 religions. The gods of various cities did not defend them. The Roman phalanx was stronger than heaven. Now, observations of this kind forced upon a people which had long existed, at least with a comparatively provincial attitude. I will not say a people that had not passed through disasters and mistakes and a certain degree of conquest was important because it uprooted something else that was very strong in the classical mind. Athens could be conquered 1,000 times by Macedonia or other nations. But to the Athenians, in their particular pattern, this was punishment. They did not doubt the gods. Punishment made them believe but more firmly in the gods. Because the Athenians, in the privacy of their own convictions, were fully aware of their own delinquencies. And the evil man with a bad conscience regards defeat usually as punishment. But as the picture grew in proportion, when good and bad, old and new, wise and foolish, all together were trampled under the feet of the Roman legionaries, it was no longer possible to fall back upon this moralism. It became obvious that the world was moving from a philosophical foundation and a religious foundation to what we might term a scientific economic foundation. The Greeks themselves probably began to understand why this had happened, but they could not check the momentum. For 300 years following the zenith of the Periclean period, there had been a gradual division in knowledge. By degrees, knowledge as science was divided from knowledge as religion. Philosophy was held in a kind of abstract aloofness. It was a kind of ancient and wise ancestor. But younger philosophers began to build bridges and roads. They began to seek outlets upon practical levels, and they also became conscious of the need for an economic reward for the various activities. By degrees, state control of religion gave place to private worship. And the advancement of religious and philosophic systems passed into the keeping of individuals. Immediately, of course, they began to fail, because the individual was not sufficiently unselfish to support them. All these elements together terminated in a grand disillusionment. A disillusionment which caused philosophy to stand and recite its own obituary over the ashes of a magnificent era, an era in which immense progress had been made. But this progress had now passed from its original keepers to those who would use it and abuse it for their own ends. It was no longer possible to control knowledge. It was no longer possible to keep the secrets of higher learning from the corrupt. Any strong man could seize the college or the temple, and could, if he so desired, pillage it, destroy it, or twist its curriculum or its creed to his own advantage. Egypt reports the same thing. Now let us go to the other side of the world and see what was happening. The beginning of the Christian era marked the end of the philosophic era of Taoism. Approximately the year 40 or 50 A.D., Taoism ceased to be a philosophy in China and verged toward a state theology. Your Taoist philosopher, your scholar, the man to whom Taoism meant the personal experience of God through tremendous discipline upon self, this philosopher disappeared almost completely from the descent of the subject. In its place emerged Taoistic theology, very largely derived from certain aspects of indigenous Chinese religion and Buddhist ritualism. We now have the Taoist believer who, through prayers and relics, believed that he could preserve his own soul. It was now a problem of Taoism telling the people. It was no longer a problem of a man gradually coming to merit enlightenment, to earn his own salvation. Salvation must come to him easily, in ritual, formula, mantra, or through some strange magical means. For magic, as an escape from labor, was always an interesting possibility. At the same time in China, in the first century, within a few years of the beginning of the Christian era, Confucianism was declared to be a state religion. Dividing with Taoism and Buddhism the spiritual leadership of the Chinese people. What was the result? The great ethical code of Confucius, a very severe code, depending for its validity upon the conscientious conduct of the individual, began to drift into oblivion. Men paid great homage to Confucius. His name became venerated above all other names. But they forgot to keep his rules. To merely affirm them, to accept them, to say, "I am a Confucianist," was to be in good taste and good style. The rest was ignored. So we see exactly the same situation coming. We find that 600 years of Taoistic and Confucianistic philosophy in China led not to the rise of a great disciplined China, but to the building of countless temples filled with innumerable images, worshipped in part by writing a prayer upon a piece of thin paper, chewing it up and spitting it onto an image. Either Confucius or Lao Tzu would have turned in their graves under such a procedure. Yet it represented a change that was to show why China was never able, in the classical or ancient period, to establish itself upon a solid level of ethical integrity. It was always a country in which the strong pillaged the weak. First in the name of heaven, second in the name of Confucius, and finally in the name of the Mandarin himself. About this time, we moved to India. What was happening to Buddhism? In precisely 600 years, Buddhism came to its first great crossroad. Philosophic Buddhism, as represented by the original teachings of the great Eastern philosopher, might be said to have comparatively died. Original Buddhism was nearly extinct in its own homeland. In its place arose the great, marvelous era of Buddhistic metaphysics. At this time came the multiplication of images. At this time came the tremendous ritualism of Buddhism and the simple agnosticism of the original teacher was reflected in a system which developed over 10,000 divinities. Now, we must not say that all of this represented loss. Let us rather say that in Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, in the Avestic philosophies of Persia, and in the condition in the Near East at the beginning of the Christian era, the tip was a very distinct motion, tipping from discipline to devotion. In every system, faith came to take precedence over discipline. Most critics have said that discipline was just too difficult. Hegel has attempted to give us a summary of what he regards as the motions of these elements, and I jotted down a few words from Hegel. Hegel attempted to point up the fact that history, in its deepest aspect, is essentially the story of man's spiritual conviction. He also came to the conclusion that different races, different nations, and different culture groups, although passing through similar periods and cycles, were distinct because of the emphasis which they placed upon the conduct of man. This emphasis becoming the basis of the entire sociological pattern that followed. History was therefore the record of the results of moral emphasis as this affected vast aggregates of human beings and became the basis of the laws under which these human beings lived. In this point, Hegel gives us five keynotes of religions, which he regarded as basic historical factors. He says, for example, that Judaism is the emphasis of duty, that the entire development of this faith and the effect of it upon other peoples and within its own group was the growing, intensifying recognition the essential fact of duty. Duty was the great virtue. He then says that the emphasis by Confucius was order. That the purpose of the Confucian code was primarily to preserve absolute order in all relationships and in all processes. That the moment order is endangered, continuity is endangered. Because the moment things get out of pattern or out of arrangement, chaos sets in upon them. Disorder leads to death unless it can be corrected. Perhaps that is why we refer frequently to forms of illness as disorders. If they are allowed to continue in society, disorder becomes the sickness which is mortal, which is finally the disintegrating and destroying factor. He gives as the great ethical keynote of Muslimism, justice, and emphasizes that upon this concept, we can have exactitudes which may go to the excess of injustice. Yet without justice, the state cannot survive. The individual who is not convinced within himself that he lives within a condition of justice can never maintain or preserve his own morality and ethics. For that reason, the moment a cultural group or a social order becomes delinquent, it accuses its leaders of injustice or exonerates its own by them. Thus, the moment leadership becomes unjust, followers become equally unjust in their relations to each other. And this ultimately destroys the moral ethical fabric of a people. Hegel, in an interesting enough way, gives us the keynote of Buddhism: patience. And he regards patience as the key word to Eastern history. Patience is a very great virtue, unless it leads to inertia. A patient man is not one who is dead, nor one lacking in incentive, or lacking in the imponderables of effort. A patient man is one who has learned within himself one undeniable fact, namely, that you can hasten nothing beyond its natural speed. Impatience leads to injustice, for it attempts to exaggerate the pace of things, or becomes dissatisfied at the slowness of achievements, or attempts to force that which can only be accomplished by growth from within itself. Thus, patience is a great and powerful thing. And history is a valid record of the ultimate victory of patience, inasmuch as all good things have been of slow maturing, but have consequently endured long. Hegel then gives us, as his final group classification, Christianity as the emphasis upon the concept of love. Now, he himself points out that without a sense of duty, without law and order, without justice, and without patience, there can be no love. You cannot have true love apart from all these considerations. Therefore, he is perfectly willing to accept that history is the record of the meeting, dividing, reunion, blending, synthesizing of these great streams, and that what we call modern man has inherited these five great social concepts, and that these concepts, in some relationship, in some pattern, either separately or together, constitute the impulse which results in history. That without these factors, man would remain eternally static, or would be the victim of such caprices of conduct that the results could never be classified and might be considered to be an endless pageantry of incident and accident. Now, we said earlier that with Christianity began the basic concept of history, for the reason that in Christianity, for the first time, was clearly enunciated the doctrine that creation and the descent of created things, particularly as outlined in the Old Testament, stood clearly to indicate the unfoldment of a divine purpose through a series of connected incidents which must lead ultimately to the regeneration and perfection of creation. Thus we may say, for the first time, the grand archetype of all occurrence, all incident, all circumstance, being part of something. This archetypal vision is found, for example, in the history of Eusebius. Truly, at that time, and later in the historical morality of St. Augustine, there was no great attempt to break away from the biblical descent of history. The early church historians were not interested in Egypt, except for the interludes of Joseph and Moses, or perhaps the flight of Jesus into Egypt. Egypt, as itself, was only part of a framework. These same historians had no particular concern for Greek philosophy or Greek history, and, as we can tell from studying their works, were totally unaware of the history of the Eastern Hemisphere. They had not accomplished their purpose, but they had advanced the idea that from the hypothetical Adam to the latest newborn babe, all generation was tied together in something. That it was an unfolding of a divine plan. Today, the modern man will probably resent, in some instances, this reference to divine plan. But he maintains the same concept when he thinks of history as the sequential unfoldment or evolution of life. For he causes evolution to stand for the progressive development of a plan or a pattern, or the gradual unfoldment of life from something, through something, to something. In this way, the Medes and the Persians are rescued into the life of modern man. The past becomes a valid experience, just as we accept in human life that the past is a conditioning factor in our psychological perspective, our philosophical and moral understanding of things. We note, therefore, throughout the then existing and civilized world, and to a measure, there is indication and evidence even in our Western Hemisphere, among the ancient records of the peoples of the Central American area particularly, that about the beginning of the first century, there was a tremendous moral, ethical, spiritual upheaval, which seems to have occurred primarily inside of man, and to have moved him to a comparatively new stage of his own development. We have a parallel for such upheaval, which is not explainable historically and becomes an unhistorical fact in the transition, for instance, between childhood and adolescence, or between adolescence and maturity. The individual is affected by his environment, but certain biological processes inevitably release psychological tendencies, and these are native to and natural to the unfoldment of man himself as a human being. He must pass through these phases. Some may have a more difficult time than others. Some may find the experience a magnificent adventure, others a dismal and neurotic episode, but still the change must take place. And it seems to be the same in this problem of history. History is punctuated by certain unhistorical events which have to do with the internal life of those creatures growing through history. History defines the boundaries of their achievements, but it cannot completely capture the stages of maturity through which these beings pass. For the transitional and historical growth stimulate something within man, releasing faculties, powers, and perspectives previously latent. These are then dumped into the historical arena and result in a rapid and amazing change in the historical perspective itself. Thus, man made by history reaches a certain point in the making in which he turns and makes history. Then, having made history, he falls into the pattern which he himself has created, may become the victim of it, may ultimately become decadent by clinging to pattern, and then after a certain length of time, finds himself again being fashioned by history, rebelling, and becoming once more a creator of history. The cycle goes on and on and on. At the beginning of the Christian era, we therefore observe very definitely that four, actually, of Hegel's principles were already functioning, although justice was not at that time primarily associated with Islamism, for this came in 600 years later at another critical point. But justice in a sense existed, but not in the sense which it was later to assume or to produce the results which it was later to produce through the rise of the Muslim world, because the Muslimism became the justice balance which prevented Western civilization from passing into a state of complete autocracy. The balance wheel was established. But certainly Buddhist patience, Judaistic duty, and Confucian law and order were all available in the experience of man at the beginning of the Christian era. Thus we observe a tremendous change taking place at this particular time. The change was not as the result so much of the Roman mind, because it is doubtful if the Roman gave it any consideration at all. It was the effect of the Roman conduct upon the non-Roman mind.